This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:02. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with host Lisa Loving. Today we're going to talk some more about school closures.
KBOO Radio is proud to help sponsor Threshold, Blackwater Snake, a benefit for the Oregon Acupuncture and Naturopathic Associations. Saturday, February 9th, from 9 p.m. to 4 a.m., will be a Chinese New Year party, and Sunday, February 10th, from 6 to 10 p.m., will be a benefit auction fundraiser. Both events will be held at Refuge PDX, 116 Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. The Blackwater Snake is intuitive, a socially adventurous spirit that loves taking risks. The theme encourages discovery of balance in the feminine and masculine energies within ourselves, our relationships, our communities, and the world at large. More information can be found at kboo.fm/threshold2013.
It's a new year, and Black History Month is now upon us to reflect the issues unique to Black African peoples. Join me, Sequoyna Wright, a KBOO volunteer regular, every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. for the month of February, starting February 2nd, as I discuss with special guests Tariq Nasheed, Dr. Umar Johnson, Dr. Claude Anderson, and my very own father about the present state of Black America. Topics include love and relationships, mental health, music, and economics. Tune in and join in on the conversation on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Hi, this is Per Fogring, host of Fight the Empire. Thursday, my guest will be journalist and author Pepe Escobar. We'll look at the fighting in Mali and a new global gold rush. The future of the dollar may well be at stake. That's Thursday, February 7th at 9:30 a.m. A talk with Pepe Escobar on KBOO, your radio station.
It's 8:05, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Lisa Loving, and this morning, now the Portland school superintendent has moved away from suggesting Vernon and Woodlawn schools for shutdown, and on Friday targeted Chief Joseph Elementary instead, all in the Jefferson cluster. This morning, school closure part two. What should we really do to reform our schools? What are your ideas on concrete steps we, the people, and our public officials could or should take to actually create an educational system that works? So, pals, this morning, we do not have a guest. So that means you, the listeners, are the guests. Okay? you, the listeners, are the guests. And to set up this throwdown, I want to read from a three-part series that was published in Truth Out last year, truthout.org, if you ever heard of Truth Out. Anyway, the series is called The Disaster Capitalism Curriculum, The High Price of Education Reform. It's a three-part series by Dan Archer and Adam Bessie. You know, it was published in Truth Out in this totally juicy format. It's an interactive comic book, okay? It has copy like a story, but the comic book is set up in such a way that you hover your mouse over it and it takes you to documents. I really highly recommend it. So this is part two, the disaster capitalism curriculum. And listeners, like, what do we really need to do to create a school system that works is the question. In this three-part series, one of the things that the writers point out is that this sense that there's constantly a crisis in public education, that we never anymore have an even keel. I don't know where we have an even keel anywhere, to be honest with you, in this country. I'll just start reading. The way the system is always in a crisis. You know, every year the school systems in our state and in Washington State get cut, right? Every year. It's like the only budget balancing tool that school districts have anymore is a machete. And it's been like that for, I'd say, at least a full generation in this country, right? What does it mean that we're always in a crisis in the education system? So I'm just going to start reading from part one, but then I want to jump to part two and three really quick, and then we're going to open the phone lines to talk about this. Education is the civil rights issue of our generation, presidential hopeful Mitt Romney announced in a recent press conference. This was published in May of last year, where he also claimed that our public schools are in a state of national emergency. Ronald Reagan did the same thing in 1980. Former governor and former Bain Capital CEO Romney is now portraying himself as a civil rights hero, fighting against systemic racism and inequality that provides American children with a third world education. And the cause of this emergency? It's not the foreclosure crisis, persistent unemployment, nor the 21% childhood poverty rate. After all, the multimillionaire who made $27 million in 2010 is not very concerned about the very poor. Remember when Romney said that? As they've already been taken care of, he said. Rather, this grave civil rights injustice has been inflicted by excessively powerful special interests and union bosses that put their needs in front of the poor minority children. And Romney plans to be the 1%'s very own Martin Luther King Jr., a champion of real education reform in America. Welcome to the other side of the looking glass and into the bizarro world of so-called education reform, an upside-down universe in which up is down, left is right, and multimillionaire CEOs are civil rights heroes championing social justice while public school teachers are corrupt fat cats maintaining a status quo which oppresses students in poverty and racism. Romney's speech on education would be hilarious, that is, if anyone seemed to get the joke. Indeed, Romney's topsy-turvy view has become so commonplace in the corporate media, stated by both Republican and Democratic politicians, along with countless pundits and reporters themselves, that it verges on the cliche. So we thought, what better way to capture the bizarre world of education reform than with a serious work of journalism disguised as a comic book? Our three-part series, published over the next 3 months, is not intended to be funny, but rather to pull back the progressive propaganda disguising the neoliberal corporate nature of education reform. Our goal is to expose the free market policies that really make up education reform and how these policies threaten our public education, who supports these policies, and ultimately what we might be able to do about the disaster capitalism curriculum. This thing rocked my world when I read it. I mean, I thought I knew it all. I should know better. But totally fascinating. That's just the intro to part one. Again, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. We're having one of those days. We're doing part two of education reform. We don't have a guest, so that means you, the listeners, are going to be our guests, right? And we're really reaching out to retired and downsized educators, right? Anyway, so I'm going to go to part two of this series that was in Truth Out last year. Part two is called Murky Waters, the Education Debate in New Orleans. Remember, we were talking about disaster. What is it called? Disaster corporate education. It's interesting. It's the disaster capitalism curriculum. Fascinating. In our first episode of the disaster capitalism curriculum, The High Price of Education Reform, we expose readers to the corporate philosophies and practices that compose education reform, or GERM, the Global Education Reform Movement. I like that, GERM. The current movement to reform our schools forwards a neoconservative economic agenda It's bigger than the classroom, dog. Okay? It's bigger than the classroom. One that strives to dramatically reduce the government's role in schooling and ultimately turn schools over to private enterprise. At the same time, these marketplace policies are carefully cloaked in the progressive rhetoric of social justice, with privatization of public education presented as the only path toward equality and civil rights for children in impoverished neighborhoods. As education advocate and parent Karen Harper Royal asked, who's going to argue against policies that supposedly help the minority kids? Remember this whole thing about the Jefferson cluster that the Portland schools are looking at? They're talking about, quote, rebalancing the enrollment, unquote, in the Jefferson cluster because the school district is saying when schools are too small, they can't afford to offer quality programs in those schools. And that's why they have to shove the schools together, put more kids in a school so that they can, quote, offer quality programs, unquote. This is so deep to me. Okay, indeed, most mainstream reporting has not gone beyond the social justice surface of germ, especially in Royal's hometown of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. Talk about crisis. In our second installment, we hope to go beyond the hype of post-Katrina New Orleans. This report distills three extensive original interviews, including one with Royal, who's been actively involved in improving New Orleans schools since well before Hurricane Katrina hit. They spoke with Professor Lance Hill, executive director of Tulane's Southern Institute for Education and Research, and Professor Terry Moe, a nationally recognized expert on school vouchers, who hails from Stanford's Hoover Institute, a right-wing free market think tank at which Milton Friedman, the inventor of vouchers and the father of germ, was a prominent fellow. Through these voices, we hope to take readers into the murky waters of the debate over the New Orleans experiment. This stuff is so deep. I see that we have a couple callers. I see that there's probably somebody else. I haven't even given out the phone yet. What do we need to do, listeners, to actually create, for once and for all, an education system that actually works and is intelligent? And that number 503-231-8187. Quickly, I want to go to part three of this, just so that we could get all this stuff on the table. Okay, and the part three was so interesting. It's called The Finnish Alternative, looking at Finland, right? Reclaiming public education from corporate reform. The third and final installment of Dan Archer and Adam Bessie's The Disaster Capitalism Curriculum. They are talking with Pasi Sahlberg, Director General of the Center of International Mobility and Cooperation in Helsinki. He's talking about his book, which is called Finnish Lessons, and a small section of his many published essays, providing an alternative vision for empowering public education, a way to improve schools that few Americans have been exposed to, although one which isn't so foreign as it seems, because when this guy describes the education system in Finland, it looks a hell of a lot like the education system when I was a little kid. So we're going to the phone lines, and I know we've got Brian on the phone, and I can see somebody else is trying to call up too. Brian, what's going on?
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm just dogpiling. This education stuff, I thought we would have figured it out.
Well, you know what? I mean, and I'm going to say this. I've said this before about other things, including the education system. But I just want to note that yesterday I literally turned off my radio because it was just so sickening to hear that we are installing plants in Oregon, building drones, and probably they're getting a great tax break, which will cut our funding for schools even more.
Oh my gosh,
and, you know,
yeah.
just the idea of, you know, the complete paradox of building spy drones in Oregon and that providing jobs. It was on yesterday's morning talk show. It was just disgusting. And you know, the bottom line goes like this, and I will say this again and again. Our school system, it's not successful. We're not successful at running it. Great. Let's call in the experts. That's a complete free market proposal. Let's call Finland, Norway, Sweden, and let's contract with them to straighten out our school systems. We won't, because the thing is our free marketers and capitalists love the chaos and the disaster, and they are profiting off of it like never before. And that's my, you know, that's, I mean, that's a very simple analysis, but you know what? That's what's going on. And in the meantime, generation after generation are not getting educated. You know, they're not getting anything out of the schools. You know, I mean, It's ridiculous, you know. I mean, so we failed. Let's admit it, and let's go contract a country that, you know, will has a successful model, and let's use them as far as that goes.
Right. Thanks a lot for calling,
sure.
Brian. Brian's putting this issue on the table. Brian's looking at the drone show that was the talk radio show yesterday. Now, parents, I know you're thinking that that your school closure doesn't have anything to do with drones. I know you're thinking that. Here's what I want to toss out to you. Now, we went through this stuff with my kids 20 years ago, right? Went to the neighborhood school back in the 90s, Sabin Elementary School. We've seen all these things have happened before, parents, right? And I just want to submit to you that for us, we look at this school system that's in perpetual crisis. I was trying to talk with someone early this morning about how much money the Oregon State Legislature has literally, how many budget cuts they've handed down to the Portland Public Schools since 2010. It's like more than $60 million, right? So the money that the school district gets from the legislature, it's shrinking. The needs are growing. And as I was talking to this person early this morning, he was saying, no, that's not accurate because they're spending more per student. So, you know, there's different ways to look at it. It's like even when we try to quantify how much money is on the table for the schools, it's hard to even compare them. It's like apples and screwdrivers, right? Anyway, let's go back to the phone lines. The number to call is 503-231-8187. Especially, we are reaching out to retired or laid off educators this morning. What's your take on what should be done in the schools? And let's go to Joanne. Joanne, what do you think?
Well, I made several attempts to go to college in the past years. Anyway, here I am. Yeah, I was listening to Joe and Abe's programs yesterday on drone. I'm sickened already by before their program about drones, and it's more shock and awe. And I asked, how are we going to protect these children from the drones, too? They're probably going to use them to guard or our children or something like that. And you know what? My poor brain and heart, I just can't keep tolerating this shock and awe. But anyway, I love you, Lisa.
I love you too, Joanne. Thanks for calling. Joanne put a couple interesting things on the table there, and I, you know what? I'd like to go to college too. I'd like to go back to college. I don't actually have any hope that I'm ever going to be able to do that. What in the heck kind of country is this, right? And who's got the money and who's got the resources? It's the question. This thing about the drones. It really does fascinate me because here's the other thing that we know about the education system in the state of Oregon. Last year, this corporate sector, and I'm mixing my metaphors, but the corporate sector in Washington County came out with a report. No, I know what it was. It was metalworking. It was the metalworking sector last year in Washington County came out with a report about how many jobs had been made available in the metalworking industry and how few qualified Washington County residents there were that could take those jobs, right? So we have, anyway, let's go back to the phone lines. We've got Chris on the phone. Chris, what do you think?
Hey, I could talk about this all day. the first thing is I'm sick of people talking about education being the civil rights movement of our generation or the civil rights issue of our generation, because education was the civil rights issue of the civil rights generation. The whole movement sprang out of popular education. You look at what the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee did and Miles Horton did in order to support and undergird the popular movement of people wanting to and asserting their right to vote by educating themselves, learning how to read and write in order to pass these literacy tests, the racist bias literacy tests in the South in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. That was about popular education. And that was what drove the civil rights movement, because if the people were not educated, they did not have access to power. So education was the civil rights issue of the civil rights generation. And it is still an issue today. I think one of the things that we need to do in order to fix this problem, it's going on right now in Seattle at Garfield High School. and they're pushing back, and they're saying no to standardized testing. And it's really unfortunate that it took, you know, these tests being tied to teacher performance for them to realize that something needed to be done, and then it had to stop. I mean, we've got to realize the amount of instructional time that is taken away from our children just within the system as it is, just to test them and to give them a number that is really quite arbitrary and has been proven time and again to have no significant ability to predict their future success. And yet, we spend hundreds of millions of dollars in this country administering these tests, making these kids fill in these bubbles. They don't really care. They don't get the fact that it's connected, you know, to their ability to get into college. And yet, at the same time, it has no bearing on students' intelligence. So we have to push back on standardized testing across the board and across the country if we want to see any kind of substantial change to our students' access to real education. And finally, I think, you know, community control is our way to do that, to say, you know, this is our school. We want control over it. We want a parent board that will oversee the operation of the school, and we have to take back the schools for ourselves and for our children, and stop, you know, being beholden to corporate interests. You know, while you're talking about the education budget getting cut year after year after year, and then we have secret deals coming out of Washington County and the state legislators for Nike, how is it that we can give Nike these sweetheart deals and then we continue to put our kids on the chopping block? It doesn't make any sense whatsoever, and it's just absolutely appalling, and it makes my stomach turn. So
I hear you.
Yeah.
To talk a little bit more, I want to ask you this issue of what is a high-stakes standardized test. I've seen this issue come up, this debate come up over the past week. There's a couple of really wonderful people that are educators that I care about who say, actually, there's a place for standardized tests, and they don't want to see standardized tests in general being demonized. But what's the difference between a standardized test and a high-stakes test?
Well, a standardized test is essentially, it can be an assessment tool that's useful for diagnosing certain things that you want to know about a student's learning. So if you want to know that a student comprehends a particular passage of text, right, then there is ostensibly a place for standardized testing in that. The problem is that we have removed standardized testing from a role as simply a diagnostic tool to help the teacher in the classroom to find the gaps in a student's learning, and we've turned it into this thing that tracks a student, that will stick them in a class like a remedial reading class, that then prohibits them from taking an elective class, say in middle school or high school. So instead of going and taking Spanish and then maybe taking a journalism class, they're stuck with maybe one of those two, and then the other class has to be this remedial reading class, right? And then the studies show that often these remedial reading classes don't work, right? But that's all attached to a score that a kid got on a test. Then, you know, you get even higher stakes to the point where you cannot graduate without from high school and go on to college without completing a standardized assessment.
And that's what they're looking at in Seattle, that MAP test. Isn't that what
MAP.
It is? You yeah. have to pass that test to officially graduate.
Right. And now, and see, that wasn't a problem until now they've tied it to performance assessments for teachers. And now the teachers are standing up and saying, no, this isn't right, because the test is not a valid way to assess the performance of a teacher, because it's not a valid way to really assess the dynamic understanding and intelligence of a student. And, you know, there are different ways to do that. If you look at what schools outside of the state systems do, private schools, charter schools, they do often it's portfolio assessment, right? And they use standardized testing only to see in the bigger picture. For instance, at Oregon Episcopal School, they use one standardized test that students take a year. And it is not about the individual student. It's about the school as a whole. How does it compare nationally with other independent schools? How does it compare nationally with other high-income suburban schools? And then how does it compare nationally with the overall average of the public school system? That's all they use it for. They don't go in and say, well, you know what? You don't get to leave the school because you didn't pass this test or you didn't score high enough. Mm-hmm. And so the way that they assess student learning is dynamic. It's performative. The students demonstrate what they know and what they've come to understand in the process of taking the classes. And so it's a much more dynamic, a much more holistic approach to looking at what students know.
All right. All right.
So, anyway.
Always a pleasure to hear from you.
Yeah, thank you. So, yeah, we need to get away from this corporate control and take control of the schools for ourselves.
All right.
In our own communities.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for calling, Chris.
Thanks, Lisa.
And Chris mentioned the Nike deal. I want to say that I feel as though it was earlier this week. It was Tuesday, February 5th. OSPR, the Oregon State Public Information Research Group, put out a press release. They've got a national study looking at how offshore tax dodging by corporations impacts states. Okay. So, and they crunch the numbers. Actually, they have experts in DC that crunch these numbers. And I just want to read to you from the press release from OSPR. Offshore tax dodging blows $506 million hole in Oregon budget. Yeah, basically what the PIRGS did was they took the whole cost of all these offshore tax breaks and they crunched them down to the impact they have on the state level, okay? So I'm just going to keep reading this really quickly. Offshore tax dodging. With Oregon facing tough budget choices, OSPIRG Foundation, joined by Main Street Alliance, released a new study revealing that the state of Oregon lost an estimated $506 million due to offshore tax dodging in 2012. Many of America's wealthiest individuals and largest corporations use tax loopholes to shift profits made in America to offshore tax havens where they pay little to no taxes. Tax dodging is not a victimless offense. When corporations skirt taxes, the public is stuck with the tab. And since offshore tax dodgers avoid both state and federal taxes, they hurt taxpayers twice, said Celeste Mifrin from OSPIRG. Oregon should be using that money to benefit the public. OSPIRG Foundation estimates that in Oregon, $283 million is lost from the corporate abuse of tax havens and $223 million from individuals. By using offshore tax havens, corporations and wealthy individuals shift the tax burden to other taxpayers, forcing elected officials to make up the difference through cutting public services, growing the deficit, or raising taxes on individuals and small businesses. They have this really interesting thing down here, though, where they broke it out. For context, the estimated money lost would have been more than enough to cover the record-breaking bond measure that passed in November to upgrade Portland public schools, to fully fund Oregon's share of the Columbia River Crossing, or to give every household in Oregon a check for $335. Let's go back to the phone lines really quick. We have Melissa on the phone. Melissa, what do you think?
Hi. excuse me. I'm a parent of a Chief Joe third grader.
Thank you so much for calling. Chief Joseph. Go, Chief Joe! Go ahead.
Well, we would have actually been an Applegate family had Applegate Elementary still been open. Which I think is a huge
Oh no, your phone's breaking up. Your phone's breaking up. We're missing what you're saying. Can you stand on the roof or something and say it again?
Yes.
Great.
Chief Joe is the point, the third point of a triangle of, you know, small schools that, or not small schools, but neighborhood schools that have closed in North Portland. And as a result of, you know, an Applegate closing and a Kenton closing. And I think many of our parents are not so much upset about, you know, combining with another school as the lack of foresight and the lack of
planning,
public process, and the lack of any kind of plan that lasts beyond the next 2 years, you know, for our students.
That's so interesting, Melissa, because, again, we started out this show talking about this series that these journalists put into,
right,
and looking at the disaster capitalism curriculum. Until I looked at this, I never thought that much about what it means that the school district is always in crisis, right? And of course, Naomi Wolf did a big book a few years ago called Disaster Capitalism, what it means that the country itself, what it means politically that the country itself is always in a crisis, and what that means in terms of corporate control, or just, you know, in this situation with Chief Joseph, it's like the state cuts so much from the education budget. I was trying to calculate just in my head this morning how much money every year for the past 3 years the state legislature has passed down to the Portland schools specifically. It's like, let me ask you, what do you think, aside from the funding, I mean, what should we all be doing? What is our vision for what we should be doing in these schools to make them actually work?
Well, Chris had a good point about taking back our schools, but I think that's really difficult when the public process involved in these kinds of changes is kind of a sham. I've attended a dozen or more public informational meetings over the last, since fall, and feedback is heard, but it's not acted on, and the pushback, we can only push back so much as grassroots and as parents to take back our schools, but this is a top-down problem, specifically in Portland Public Schools, but at a state level, it's a top-down problem. So, you know, we can march and we can beg and we can plead, but until there are people with a real vision for education, this is going to get worse.
What I hear you saying is there's a leadership vacuum.
This is a leadership vacuum, and it's a huge problem. This is not just about, you know, a neighborhood school. We talk about constantly the state identifies neighborhood schools as being a priority, and clearly we're not.
Okay, we're losing your phone line, but we totally appreciate your calling, and I really appreciate what you had to say, Melissa, and please call again sometime. And this is Wednesday Talk Radio. We're looking at school reform part two this morning. As we already mentioned last week, we had Woodlawn and Vernon parents on the line talking about the new public schools, how do you call it, the Jefferson Cluster Enrollment Balancing Process, which only impacts the neighborhoods of the traditional Black community in Portland, interestingly. Looking at how the school district just is always tinkering with them. They feel like they need to do something with the balance of enrollment. They've been closing schools. Last year, two schools were closed. And so Vernon and Woodlawn were all basically on the chopping block. But then on Friday, Superintendent Carol Smith just out of the blue threw that out and said, oh no, let's think about closing down Chief Joe in a couple years. And so it is a flying fickle finger of fate, as they used to say on Laugh-In, but we're not Laugh-In, really. So let's go back to the phone lines. We have Leslie on the phone. Leslie, what do you think?
Hi, good morning, Lisa.
Hey.
I think the subtext here, as it is in many things in America, is race. Forgive my paranoia, but that's what I believe. There are three means of attack. The first is the defunding. The second is the absolute exclusion of any information or teaching about, you know, Black and brown peoples, stripping them from the history, you know, reducing Martin Luther King to a nice guy who had a dream.
Mm-hmm.
No context for teaching American history. And the third means of attack is militarizing the schools with bringing in police presence, allowing law enforcement to handle discipline instead of teachers taking the initiative of dealing with discipline and dealing with problems with students.
All right. Leslie, are you active? Are you active in the school movement? Are you marching or going out there or doing anything?
In terms of school, no, I don't have children. I should. I think my thing is more environment, but this is what I'm seeing in terms of school.
I totally understand what you're saying. Do you have a sense of what you feel like what we should be doing? The thing that strikes me about these issues is that all these local issues, I think they play out in communities all over the country. So what do you think, Leslie, we should be doing?
I think we should systematically be replacing officials who aren't listening to us with people among us who want to run for office and who agree with our viewpoint. It's obvious that the begging just isn't working. These people need to be moved out systematically. We should target them and we should move them out. That's the way the right wing did it. They came up from the bottom. They took over school boards. They took over city council positions. And that's the way we need to do it.
Right.
You know, begging these people is not working. They're not listening. They don't care.
All right, Leslie. Thanks a lot for calling. Leslie put her finger on the feeling, sort of the, I just want to give up. And I know a lot of other people do that. And the interesting thing also about school district reform, school district activism, as we see it in the modern day, is it's like an assembly line. And over time, all the activists, they sort of time out. When your kids get out of the system, you breathe a sigh of relief and you move on with your life. And so it's not like other issues, say, for example, for foreclosure, or being against the war, where you have the same activist there in the center of it doing that for maybe 20 years, 30 years. With the education activism, when your kids graduate or when your kids move on to middle school, you tend to just want to walk away because it's so frustrating. It seems futile. There's an emotional aspect to it. So let's go back to the phone lines. We have Naomi on the phone. Naomi, what do you think?
Hi. I'm not Naomi Klein, unfortunately.
Right, and so by the way, I misspoke a few minutes ago. It's Naomi Klein that wrote Disaster Capitalism. Naomi Wolf is the feminist lady.
Right.
Go ahead, Naomi, and okay. you're all those people. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I am. I want to go back to Finland because I think that there is an important lesson to be learned from Finland. In part, the lesson is the way in which schools are organized and the way in which the teachers are trained. And the way in which teachers receive very high incomes in Finland, I think incomes that I can't quote you the level, but considerably more. So they're really a kind of respected professional that would be on the level of the way maybe that we perhaps used to treat medical physicians. But the second point I think that I want to make is even more important, and that is that you could talk about the inside of the schools and how the schools are run and who's allowed to make decisions, and those are all very important. But the thing I think that Americans tend to overlook, even in referring to the success in Finland, is the social context. I've always thought that when you want to evaluate teaching, quote-unquote, that what you have to consider is the neighborhood in which kids live. Do they have good housing? Do the families have good wages and stable wages? Are the streets safe? Can the kids walk to school if they want to, or bike to school if they want to? They don't have to be overseen always by their parents. So the point, and do they have good health care? Do they have job opportunities when they become young, graduated adults? So I think that it's really important that when we think about doing things to reform the schools, that we think about the context in which the students live.
Thanks.
And in which the students study, in which the students think about the world in which they live and the opportunities that they're going to have when they graduate high school.
Again,
or go
yeah,
to college.
Pulling the camera back and looking at all the things that impact the school district, looking at all the things that the school district impacts.
And
yeah, it's interesting to me.
The society in which we live. We do the same thing, I think, with another issue, which is health care. We think about health care as something that's located in the individual and the individual doctor. And we talk about the schools, or school reform, we think about the schools and the people who are in the schools, and we don't think about the world in which those schools are located. And the advantage that the Finns have over us, they have a homogeneous society in terms of access to those things that I mentioned, good health care, good housing, good wages.
And it's interesting you put that, because this comic actually goes into
that.
This comic actually specifically goes into that.
Oh, good. What's the comic you mentioned?
Okay, check it out. It's called, I'm going to go back, and now I've got so many windows open. It's called The Disaster Capitalism Curriculum. The Disaster Capitalism Curriculum, a three-part series that was reprinted in Truth Out. And I want to thank you so much for calling, Naomi. Put a whole bunch of these issues right back on the table. You know, the schools don't exist in a vacuum. But when we talk about school reform and we talk about school funding and all these things, we don't have someone from the school district that's, say, for example, I don't know, represented at the Metro Council. Yet the school district has an impact on traffic, real estate, all these different things. And so the school district makes decisions that totally impact the city. Yeah. And then people complain and say, oh, well, the mayor has nothing to do with education. Interestingly, Charlie Hales has mentioned already, and this is something that you already said something about, Naomi. He's already mentioned that he's probably going to eliminate the student bus pass for this year. And the cost of families to get their kids to school using TriMet, it can be unbelievably prohibitive. If you've got two or three kids and you're going to have to spend $150 a month just getting them to school, guess what? They're not going to get to school. Thanks a lot for calling, Naomi, and let's go back to the phone lines. We have Lee on the phone. Lee, what's going on?
Hi.
Hey.
I heard you were going to open another window. I hope it's going to bring in some fresh air.
We can hope.
You mentioned something about capitalistic curriculum and corporate control.
Yeah.
And I'd like to cite a few statistics I've gleaned from newspaper articles.
Okay.
November 16th of 10, the Oregonian published a statistic of 35 hours, 34 minutes, which is the number of hours and minutes the average American watches TV per week, according to Nielsen Media Research. That's more time than kids spend in school. And if you talk about capitalistic curriculum and corporate control, there the television is what is educating our society.
Mm.
In October of 06, another article says the average American home now has more television sets per than people. That threshold was crossed within the past 2 years, according to the Nielsen Media Research. There are 2.73 television sets in the typical home and 2.55 people.
All right. All right. Lee, let me ask you a question. Are you an educator?
I was a senior research assistant at the Forest Products Department at Oregon State University, involved with continuing education and extension education.
What's going on? What do you have a sense of like how the number of people, you know, passing through that has changed in the past few years? It's interesting because on the college level, and this is an important point, the governor of Oregon, I'm not the biggest fan of Governor Kitzhaber, but I really have to admire his attempt to try to actually do something radically different theoretically, by creating an education system that basically tracks kids from kindergarten all the way through college. And we've seen where in the past 5 years, the Oregon colleges really are at capacity. It's like more people are going to school, even though it's more expensive, there's more student loan defaults and all these things. What do you see there? What's going on there?
I see it as a corporate, with the amount of student debt that's now involved in this country, I see corporations using colleges as a
ATM
way to indenture and put people into debt. I don't see that there are jobs out there, and you know, you ask, you know, what should we do?
Yeah.
I think we ought to kill our televisions and get out in the streets and interact with people and demand change.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling, Lee. Call again, please.
I try. Once in a while, I'll scare you, though.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. We try not to get too scared. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. Today, this is Education Reform Part 2. Last week, we had parents from Vernon and Woodlawn schools whose schools were on the chopping block for Portland Public Schools. But on Friday afternoon, late Friday afternoon, Portland Public Schools Superintendent Carol Smith completely threw all that out and started and pointed at Chief Joseph Elementary School as a school that would be closed. And so this morning, we're looking at, you know, we're just raising this question. what do we really need to do to reform our schools? Because this flying fickle finger of fate award, it seems to engender turmoil in a chronic manner. And we do not have a guest this morning, so that means that you listeners are the guests, and we're really reaching out to retired or laid off educators this morning. What's your take on what should be done, and what it, and help us define some of these terms? The number to call, of course, is 503-231-8187. And we have Gordon on the phone. Gordon, what do you think?
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, the corporate takeover is pretty bad, and that comes with the debt and the federal debt, the local debt, and but really, I think what we have to do is really have to go back to the basics and the fundamentals, and that's the food that the kids are eating, and if we go back into the time they spend in front of the television because of this capitalistic society. We have parents that are forced to go out and get 2-3 jobs apiece, and the parents are not home anymore. So now you have these televisions educating our children and telling them what's right, what's wrong, what's beautiful, what's not. And a lot of this stuff is taken in because they can't think for themselves because they're being poisoned on a daily basis from the preservatives, which are oil that runs in your car, which coats the myelin sheath. The oil also coats the preservatives, and the food colorings coat the neurotransmitters. So you can't get these kids to think because they're short-circuiting. So if we can educate the people on how to eat again, and that's a long shot, but you know, I think getting good food in the kids and having quality time with their parents and not buying into this capitalistic society, I think we have a solid foundation to work from.
All right. Thanks a ton for calling, Gordon. Thanks a ton. Gordon raises a really interesting point there. He's basically, again, we're looking at all the other things that impact education. What I really want people to look at is, you know what, the food, the television, all these things, but there's something wrong with the system. Like, we can all, I don't know what we're going to do to get everybody to eat healthier food. Although we see loads of programs coming into the public schools all over the country to encourage kids to eat healthier, to encourage kids to eat locally grown food. Portland School, I feel as though it was in 2011 or 2012, did a year-long program where they featured produce that was from local farms that was brought into the cafeteria, right? And, of course, Alice Waters, right? Alice Waters down in Berkeley, she has done a ton around food education in the public schools. And you know what's really interesting? You always see where people act like those things are completely frivolous. Right? So that thing that we had here at Portland Schools, it's like putting healthy food in that. Well, that was a one-year program. Right? And every time somebody does something like this, there's always ends up being a budget. It's got to cost money. Somebody's got to administrate it. I just want to put to you, let's even try to dig down a little deeper and say, what about the system? How does the system work? And let's go back to the phone lines. Of course, the number to call is 503-231-8187. We have Charlene on the phone. Charlene, what's going on?
Hi, thank you. So I'm a retired teacher, 31 years in Oregon schools, and I have been retired for 8 years and have been substitute teaching, so I'm still active in the schools. And what I've seen, and I think this is a huge impact, is that just about every classroom has increased by about 10 students. So where there was 25 students before, there's now 35 students. So that has really changed the landscape of what a teacher can do, even just getting around to each student or collecting or passing out or grading. But all these things, talking to parents, it's just multiplied the job. And classroom management has gotten to be more of an issue, too, because the kids, there's just so many of them that sometimes it's really hard to get every single person. Plus, more handicapped kids are in the classroom, plus more kids who don't speak English are in the classroom, and there's more pullouts for all these different students. So you have kids coming and going all the time. so you're not really sure who's what students are receiving which part of your education, because sometimes the ESL teacher has to come earlier or later or whatever, and so you're not it's to accommodate that program. Plus, the teachers have less of a say. I have a little analogy that when I first started teaching in the early 70s, teachers were like doctors. You had your class, you could diagnose, you could treat, you could do everything. And your principal was there to assist you and to make those things happen. Whatever you asked for, pretty much you could get, or you could get their advice. But now teachers are like nurses. You still need a college education and things, but you're not allowed to diagnose or treat or prescribe or anything like that. That is for somebody else, the school board or the principals or the administrators. And you are just told, okay, this is what you're doing, and this is how you're doing it, and go for it, you know, kind of a thing. And you don't really have any kind of freedom to change any of that, which we did. And I think that's one of the reasons why there's such a move to do the early retirement benefits and things, to get these teachers who knew what it was like to really run their own classroom and have quite a bit of say, to get them out, and to have the newer teachers who never knew that. And the final thing, I think, is the technology. The students realize that they can go on their little handheld smartphones and get the kind of education where you just have answers. I mean, that's not a big deal. That's not a reason why they want to learn anything. That's all available instantly. But the whole idea of creative thinking and putting together critical thinking, and those things are not available on their smartphones and on their little handhelds. And those are things that are hardest in these huge classrooms to impart to the students.
Mm.
So there's even a disconnect for the students sometimes on what it is that they need to learn and why. So anyway, those are just some thoughts to start with.
Charlene, you rock. I wish you'd called right at the top of the hour, and I hope you call again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Charlene put a lot of stuff on the table there. And, you know, looking at how education has changed since the 70s, when I was a kid, right? That's when I was a kid in elementary school, was in the 70s. And I remember I loved going to school. I loved my teacher. I loved learning things. I loved all the stuff they had. And I loved the food in the cafeteria. Isn't that nutty? They actually cooked it there. And they served it on plastic trays that were washed in the building. And now it's, I don't even want to think about how old I am. It's like 40 years later. And now we're sort of looking at those days. Oh, those are the ideals. Well, gee, what happened between then and now is the question. And a lot of things have happened. But as Charlene said, we do have a couple callers. As Charlene said, the classroom sizes are so big now. They've gone from 20 to, say, 30. That's the interesting thing that hurts me. Every time I look at the Portland Public Schools administrators and these messages about we have to cut the schools, we have to close these schools in the Jefferson cluster because the schools are too small and we can't offer quality programs, right? And yet when they shove all the kids together, they actually retard the ability of those educators that they're paying to teach these kids these things. And when I say retard, I mean that the dictionary definition of that word. It's like we all know what best practices are, and we don't even try to reach them. What we're trying to do is stuff a sausage. And why don't we look at that? That's what I'm really getting at. And I don't really see people calling the school district administration on it, although I guarantee you that there are school district administrators that say these things behind closed doors. I know it's true. So let's quickly go back to the phone line and see if we can get everybody on the air before we run out of show. We have Stephen on the phone. What do you think, Stephen?
So I've been a school counselor for about 15 years, and my perspective is a couple things. One is people talk about, you know, well, sorry, we just don't have the money. And I like to say, well, where is it? It didn't vaporize, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, where is the money now? Well, I mean, I think we all know, I mean, I think most of your listeners know where that money and wealth is concentrated now.
Yeah, so, because I already talked about the Osberg report that was that just came out yesterday about the offshore. What impact offshore investments and offshore tax havens have on the state level? And they're basically saying Oregon's been hit by that to the point where the entire Portland Public Schools bond measure could have been paid if people paid proper taxes. Go ahead, though, Stephen.
Where's the money?
So you keep going.
I think that's kind of a bad excuse, because there's money. We just need to have the you-know-what to go after it instead of saying sorry and throwing our hands up.
We just prioritize education, but go ahead.
Right. And one of the things that I've seen in schools is we do need to reform our schools. Unfortunately, the reform that's going on right now is all about privatizing, right? It's about making money. But our schools do need to be reformed. So it's not like we should be fighting for just going back to how things were. Because how things have been is this industrial age really teaching kids not to be empowered and not to question. And the ones that are really rewarded the most, I see it especially in elementary schools, are the ones that follow the rules and are sit quietly. And,
sit down and shut up, yeah.
Right. And so if we want to reform our schools, yeah, we need to look at countries like Finland and other countries that are doing. And we also have a lot of good ideas here in this country about, you know, promoting creativity and really encouraging kids to use their own curiosity to drive their learning instead of telling them what they need to learn every, you know, second of the day. So there are all kinds of ideas out there. It's a matter of sort of getting some energy behind those.
The leadership vacuum thing again. Anyway, we're running out of show. Stephen, thank you so much for calling, and thanks for waiting on the line. Let's see if we could try to get these other callers in quick like a bunny. We have, is it Michael? Michael, do we have Michael?
Yeah.
Hey, what's going on, man?
First of all, I just want to say they need to think about schools the way they think about prisons. You notice that they always have money for prisons. They're not closing prisons down. And the reason that there's more money for prisons than schools is that prisons are traded on the stock exchange. Schools aren't. And that's the real reason, one of the reasons why they close schools down and there's no money for schools. They're not traded. Another thing is that teachers and educators should be, their salary should be based on performance. It shouldn't be based on their degrees or anything like that. You know, if everybody in society was put on a commission, you know how efficient this society would be?
Right.
They got rid of salaries and put everybody on commission.
Or the hourly wage. Yeah. All right. Hey, Michael, thanks a lot for calling. We're running out of show. Michael, call earlier in the hour because you bring up controversial points that we really need to talk about. And Michael is the guy last week who talked about gay educators, right? And Michael was objecting to gay educators. Think Out Loud did a segment recently, actually since our last week's show, where they interviewed Dan Savage and they talked about how queer culture is dealt with in the schools. And they were looking at the kid who the incredible young man who hung himself and who was just taken off life support. Go to Think Out Loud. Do a web search for Dan Savage, Think Out Loud. We have one caller. Let's try to just get one more caller in because we're running out of show. We got to tell the top of the hour. Go ahead. We have Nico. Nico, what's going on?
Oh, yes. I would just like to add something to a previous caller's statements about the curriculum and the manner of which we disseminate that nonsense.
Yes.
I have a daughter right now who's enrolled in a first grade K-12 program, which is like a online homeschooling hybrid format, and I follow her curriculum pretty closely because I'm sitting there at home doing it with her most of the time, and I'm just boggled by what they pass off as legitimate information. For example, they use biblical lore as a history lesson. You know, they're just discussing Egypt. And yes, there is some cross, you know, there is some connection there, but the stories they choose to use to portray Egyptian history is just, there's no connection
there.
It's basically mythology.
Really appreciate your calling, Nico. That's it for our show. Special thanks to engineer Steve Nasser and Sky the Studio Dog. Yes, we have an entourage over here. This show will be podcast on KBOO.FM by the end of today. Grab that link and share it with your friends and family. I'm Lisa Loving. Follow me on Twitter for more news and information about the topics we discuss on this show. Theme music by the March 4th Marching Band. Thanks for listening and stay tuned for Political Perspectives.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 100.7 FM Corvallis in Albany. It's 9 o'clock straight up. Coming up next on Political Perspectives, your host Kathleen Stevenson speaks with journalist Arun Gupta about his article in These Times magazine called Disaster Capitalism Hits New York. We'll also hear an interview with Dr. Stephen J. Davis, who explains why climate solutions advanced just 9 years ago and are no longer possible. At 10 o'clock, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's The Bike Show.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of Organicology, the Northwest's largest gathering of the organic food trade. Study the organic industry and shape the future of sustainable eating. February 7th through 9th at the Hilton, 921 Southwest 6th Avenue in Portland. Again, that's Organicology, February 7th through 9th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/organic2013.
Hi, this is Love Jones, producer and DJ for The Confessional. I'm so pleased to invite you to join us on Valentine's Day, February 14th, starting at 6:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, a benefit for KBOO. It's going to be an amazing night filled with sing-alongs, contests, a live performance by La Contessa de la Luna herself, and of course, the Alfred Hitchcock movie, Rear Window. This is your opportunity to redeem Valentine's Day. Join us February 14th, starting at 6:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater of 26th and Clinton in Southeast Portland for La Contessa de la Luna's Valentine's Day Spectacular.
This is Contessa de la Luna inviting you to join us live at the Clinton Street Theater on Valentine's Day. Kiss, kiss.
Hi, this is Per Fogring, host of Fight the Empire. Thursday, my guest will be journalist and author Pepe Escobar. We'll look at the fighting in Mali and a new global gold rush. The future of the dollar may well be at stake. That's Thursday, February 7th at 9:30 a.m. A talk with Pepe Escobar on KBOO, your radio station.
Good morning. This is Kathleen